This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you have a child of a certain age, chances are they already have asked for, or maybe already have, a cell phone. That indispensable, transformational piece of technology has worked its way down to younger and younger owners, but it has also raised some questions and concerns. When should you say yes to that request for a cell phone? How closely should you monitor calls, texts, social media postings on that phone and on a child's computer? Given the addictive nature of these pieces of technology, can too much time be spent staring at that little screen? And can it be harmful in some way to a child's well-being or development? We take a look at all of that this hour with Dr. Catherine Steiner-Adair, a Harvard Medical School clinical psychologist and author of The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. She joins us by phone from Maine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And with us in our Spirit Square studio is Dr. Mary Lacey and Michelle Eichard. Dr. Lacey is a doctor of behavioral health in private practice in Ballantyne. She works exclusively with adolescents and young adults who suffer with anxiety and depression as well as self-esteem issues. And that's part of what results in too much frequent use of social media without some constructive understanding of how it works. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Michelle Eichard is a local parent and author of Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. She also operates the website michelleinthemiddle.com, which has tentacles everywhere, it seems. Welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Good to see you again. Is there an easy answer to the question, when is it appropriate for a child to have a cell phone? Let me begin with Dr. Steiner-Adair. Give me an answer to that question, if you can.
Well, I think it's appropriate by high school because beginning in high school, kids have so much of their work and their communications with their teachers and their friends through their cell phones. And I think in many schools, increasingly, that's becoming the case at some point in middle school. But in my travels around the country, that really varies from school district to school district. I've seen a great deal of range. You know, in some areas, kids have smartphones that are fully loaded with full access in third and fourth grade, which I don't think is a great idea. And other communities wait on average till about seventh or eighth grade, anticipating high school.
And Michelle, you say it is the societal norm that most kids in the sixth grade, between 11 and 12 years old, have a cell phone. Well, who made that rule?
It's certainly not a rule. It's just, I think what we see more and more is that by the time a kid goes off to middle school, it's almost a rite of passage. Mm-hmm. And so parents will say, yes, you're allowed to have a cell phone now. I don't disagree with that choice. And it varies. Sometimes that's a smartphone, and sometimes that's just an old flip phone. But typically, I think by middle school, you do see lots of kids who have cell phones. And I agree that teachers now are sending assignments home via phone and the web. And so my son, for his math homework in seventh grade, had to check his cell phone every night and see what the teacher had sent.
Why cell phone? Why couldn't he check it on his computer? Because she texted it out to people?
Yeah, there's a texting system that alerts you. He could go to his computer.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is probably a little off the topic, but a cell phone, a flip phone is one thing, a smartphone is another. Is there a difference? There's certainly a difference in the mind of the owner, but is there a difference in terms of what is appropriate for a child of certain ages?
Well, I think the most important thing is when you give a child of any age a smartphone with access to the internet, with texting privileges, with the camera and so forth, you sit down as a family and come to an understanding that is posted on the refrigerator about what this phone is for. It's not for taking embarrassing pictures. It's not for spreading rumors. It's not for going on sites on the web that we know, you know, that you're not allowed to. And I think parents can also think very strategically about at what age they want children to have access to different apps, to the internet, etc. And there are increasingly available good controls for parents to be able to determine what a child can put on their phone, but most of all, as families, to sit down and talk about how to use the phone and, again, what the consequences will be if they make mistakes, which you should totally expect. It is completely understandable that kids are going to want to roam in places they might not belong.
Dr. Lacey.
You know, I feel like just because of the very nature of the cell phone industry and the profitability there's very few flip phones available without internet connection, I've found. But they're increasingly more popular also because there's a rising number of divorces and blended families. Mm-hmm. And cell phones are imperative to speak to children and to avoid maybe that parental relationship so that you can get in touch with your child at your leisure.
Well, I was going to ask about that because we live in this world of helicopter parents, and it seems to me that the phone for the child may be more important to the parent because it's an umbilical cord.
That's exactly something that I've thought about myself. Especially in carpool, you see a lot of the moms calling as opposed to in the olden days, you get out and yell their name. You just text and find out where your child is, and they immediately come out. There's no more of that interaction of going into the school. So,
is that healthy?
You know, it does save a lot of voice loss, stress. But yeah, you know, there's a lot less interaction, a lot less face to face. So that's a question too that I'm sure Dr. Steiner Adair could answer.
Yes, is it healthy? I mean, if parents are using this as a connective device, so they always know where their child is, because with these smartphones, you can actually locate where the phone is and therefore where the child is it healthy?
You know, I think that we've seen a spike in parental anxiety and smartphones for a host of reasons. Certainly post 9/11, we've seen a spike in parental anxiety, and the news and the media of disasters 24/7 has led to a spike in parental anxiety. And the myth is that, you know, by knowing where your child is, you'll be able to help them. And this actually is often very mistaken. For example, when kids go on school trips, parents often really push hard and pressure the teachers for the kids to be able to have their smartphones in case something happens. However, if something happens and your child's on a school trip, you don't want them texting their parents at the office. You want their full attention on the teachers who know exactly what to do in that emergency situation. So we're seeing a false sense of security that actually undermines kids developing competencies, trusting other adults, turning to peers. You know, when you go off to college, you ask your roommates, you know, what should I wear? What class did you take? Have you had this professor now? You know, kids, as they make that huge transition to college, are taking photographs of their, you know, mom, should I wear these shoes with this dress? Or please read the English course load and tell me what you think. So normal areas of separation and individuation are sometimes slowed down because we can stay in constant connection with our kids. And it goes both ways. It's parental hesitancy to let their children go and children's, you know, desire to just completely continue to depend on their parents. But that said, there are wonderful ways kids and parents can communicate through texting that are lovely and enriching of our relationship.
Yeah, there have been conversations about the impact of screens since the invention of television. And I remember people talking about not letting kids sit too close to the TV or spend too much time in front of a television set as a child. And we all lived through it and we're fine today. And the telephone has always been a thing for teenagers. There's a whole number in a Broadway show called Bye Bye Birdie called The Telephone Hour. Every kid in Sweet Apple, Ohio is on the phone talking to every other kid in Sweet Apple, Ohio about who's hooking up with whom. So is this any different? Is this cell phone culture that we see today any different than the landline culture that we had as teenagers before the advent of cell phones? Of course, kids aren't talking on the cell phone as much. They're texting on the cell phone. They're surfing the web on the cell phone. But is there a difference in this?
I think the root need to connect with your peers, especially when you start off in middle school and then heading into high school, remains the same. And I think the need for some privacy to do that apart from your parents' eyes is legitimate and something that we ought to respect. So kids are not talking on the phone as much as they used to. They are texting, but that's how they're developing their peer connections and their relationships and figuring things out. And I think we ought to have a measure of respect for that.
I want to hear from the two doctors here about texting, because it's a phenomenon that I use occasionally, but I just don't get it. Because most kids, you see them all the time, they're always texting. Pick up the phone and talk. They don't do it. How is texting different? What is it doing in your brain? What is it doing to your relationships with other people? What is happening as the result of communicating through written word in very short clips during which you cannot hear inflection and you cannot see the person's intent? How is texting different from phone conversations?
Well, you're speaking to one of the most essential differences between texting and speaking on the phone, and that is perhaps one of the most powerful tools of human relationships and human communication is the capacity to hear tone of voice and also the capacity to read with visual cues the impact of your words on the other person. And there's some research that suggests that as kids text more and more and more, their capacity for empathy doesn't develop as strongly. And the other thing about texting is, unlike spoken conversation, is you don't learn as much the art of being thoughtful and replying right away. You can text your friends to say, oh, what should I say? He just texted me this. You can buy time by disappearing. You feel more in control of the conversation, which is why it's so compelling to you. Now, neurologically, one thing that we do know about texting is it's not a great idea to text when you are mad or upset, because texting is like a stimulant to the brain, and we get dysregulated, and we text things at 8 or 18 or 48 that we would often not say to somebody face-to-face. It makes us angrier, we magnetize to negativity, and get much more reactive. So you have to think about what kind of conversation you're having when you text.
And Dr. Lacey, we're going to talk a little bit later on about some of the things that you, some of the people that you work with who have been negatively impacted by social media and things like that. But the same thing can happen with texting, can it not? I mean, if you're not hearing the tone of voice, or if somebody's just ripping off a very quick, abrupt text and then you don't hear from them anymore, even though you've replied to the text, they've ended the conversation. That can have an impact if you don't understand how the medium works, right?
You can. I think they're pretty up to date now with the texting. It does leave a lot of room for innuendos and like she was saying, that your voice fluctuations. But more than ever, we're seeing anxiety in children, and the texting modality actually enables those worries, those concerns, because you're not sure how that was said. Was it said spitefully? Was it said empathetically? So a lot of people can interpret, or a lot of children interpret and get insecure, have different meanings to something, and then roll with that in their own minds. And then when they're isolated in their room and they're reading these texts and they're perceiving all of these good or bad things that are coming, this is when the self-esteem is affected and anxiety. And a lot of kids don't know how to deal with the anxiety or how to cope. Don't have coping skills to deal
and
with.
And they don't learn that from their friends, because all their friends are going through the same thing. They don't have either live in-person conversations about that or texting conversations about that among each other?
I don't think so. I think that they all try to stay just as cool and calm and collected and are perceived as, you know, gotten everything under control and everything is just fine and smooth.
Something else we're going to talk about as we go through this whole thing about cell phones and social media is the wall that you can put up to hide behind or project an image that really doesn't represent you accurately, which can cause all kinds of problems. We'll talk about that. And when we come back, I also want to talk about something, Dr. Steiner, dear, that you talk about, and that is what parents are missing out when they let their kids text, as opposed to have phone conversations in the car, on the way home from school, the way back from the grocery store, or the way to and from soccer practice. We'll come back and talk about that in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion, the America the Beautiful Tour, August 14th at Uptown Amphitheater, Charlotte. Tickets available at livenation.com. Well, what if you woke up every day wondering if or where you would work? Well, thousands of people in Charlotte do. They bus, they walk, they drive to a parking lot or congregate there or on a street corner with others waiting to be hired as day laborers. And contrary to what you might think, not all are men looking for construction jobs. A lot of women out there, and not all of them are Latinos. There are a lot of people from all walks of life looking for work every single day. We look at the life and challenges faced by day laborers in Charlotte tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, The CDC reported the number of Americans who died from heroin overdoses quadrupled in the decade ending in 2013. What's behind the nation's surge in heroin addiction and what some communities are doing to fight back?
That's the Diane Rehm Show coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Catherine Steiner-Adair, research associate in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard University Medical School, a speaker and the author of The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. Sitting across from me at the table here is Dr. Mary Lacey, a doctor of behavioral health in private practice in Ballantyne, and Michelle Eichert, author of Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the middle school years. We put a question out there on social media this morning about how you deal with cell phones in your personal life. Parents, do you allow cell phones at the dinner table? What rules do you have for screen time and social media use at your house? You can let us know on Facebook and Twitter. You can search for WFAE to do that. Kara on Twitter has written in, "My son isn't having a cell phone until high school unless he starts sports in middle school. He knows this and is okay with it." And Rebecca emails, "Our son has a flip phone. You can buy them on Amazon used for about $25. It's a great alternative to a smartphone until the child or you are ready for it." Dr. Steiner-Adair, we were talking about texting before the break, and you make an interesting point. When kids used to, before cell phones, when kids would, mom and dad would pick the kids up at school or soccer practice and they'd have their friends in the back seat, you could eavesdrop on little tidbits of conversation. When phones came along and kids were using them to talk, you could eavesdrop on little tidbits of conversation. But sometimes kids in the car will be texting to each other in the car so they don't have to let you hear those little tidbits of conversation. What are parents missing by the lack of that experience?
Well, you're missing out on a lot of good info. You know, kids forget. At least my kids certainly forgot in the back of the minivan that I could hear everything they were saying. So, you know, just to hear their banter was like getting the emotional thermometer of what was going on in school. But also, you miss out on their turning to you to debrief the day. Here's what happened. Who was, you know, chosen quarterback at recess? You know, just sort of whatever's on in their little minds as they debrief their day, and instead they'll text it to the child sitting next to them in the car, and you no longer are the person they go to for advice or share their day with. So you miss out on a lot of important disconnecting after school. But the other thing that is really not so great about kids texting in the car is that neurologically, especially on the way to school, children need to give their brains a rest. They need to deal with anticipatory anxiety about going to school. And you want them to share those concerns with you or just quietly reflect in themselves what's going on, what they're expecting, did they study enough. And when you let them play Candy Crush in the car on the way to school, it makes the car ride easy, quiet, nobody fights. But neurologically, what you're doing is you're giving them a stimulant rather than an experience of dealing with anxiety and actually calming themselves down or checking in with themselves. So psychologically and neurologically, they arrive at school revved up, and they've missed out on an important time to prepare for whatever's on their mind that might be challenging or fun or exciting or difficult.
Michelle.
I think it's important to recognize when it comes to technology and kids that it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. So we're talking about a lot of things that are frightening around the idea of technology and texting and social media. But there are things that parents can do to mitigate that and also to reap some benefits from it. So I like to think of it comparing technology to a sharp knife in the kitchen. You want your kid to learn how to cook, to learn how to use this tool properly. You don't just say, stay away from knives, they're dangerous, don't ever touch this thing. But as Dr. Steiner-Adair pointed out, you set up some expectations early on for how to use the tool effectively so that you can reap some of those benefits.
How do you do that when many parents don't, many parents aren't on Twitter, they're not on, most parents are on Facebook now, but many parents don't do Instagram, they don't do Snapchat, they don't do Pinterest. How do you tell your child how to use these tools if you yourself don't use them and don't know the downfall and the upside?
I think in the first place, it's hard to teach a kid how to use a tool that you don't know how to use. So you should go on there and look around or ask a friend or read a book about it or listen to a radio show. I mean, there's a lot you can do to educate yourself on the tool. And the second thing is that we don't have to pressure ourselves to keep up with all of the technology. In fact, we can't. The second we figure out a platform, the kids will jump to the next one, one step ahead of us. It's more important to think about what are your parenting goals, what are your communication goals, and establish your technology rules around that. So if you want to have good conversations with your kids, you don't allow the cell phone in the car, but you may say there's a time of day when it's appropriate for you to go on your social media account. Here's when that is.
You know, we're all interconnected, whether you're on Facebook or you're on LinkedIn or whatever it is. We're all interconnected with everybody in the world now. But are we really connecting? That's the question. Are these social media tools that we have at our disposal and that particularly young people use 24/7, are they being brought together? Or, Dr. Lacey, are they being pushed apart? Are we really connecting? Are we more connected than we used to be or less?
Well, I think we're both. We're definitely able to contact each other more frequently and with more ease.
But are these really connections, these little 140-bit character things that we're typing onto our cell phone screens, are they really connecting us, aside from making appointments?
Well, and that's the argument, because Facebook is, you have 850 friends, right? And how many have you actually seen in the last 20 years? It's almost turned into a little porthole to see other people's lives. Compare yourself to those people. See what they're doing. See what vacations they're going on. See what they're wearing, where their kids are going to school. Kind of exposing everyone or what they want to expose to the world.
And that's kind of key here, because if you're 12 or 13 years old, you don't know that the world can be a cruel place, and you don't know that your friends may actually be being cruel. You're putting your, if you're smart, you're putting your best foot forward.
Absolutely.
On your social media pages.
Absolutely.
So you're putting, in some cases, a foot forward that nobody could emulate. It's not possible to be that great.
No, and then when you're isolated as a tween in your room, you're comparing yourself,
right?
And you don't have the proper reasoning skills. Your prefrontal cortex isn't completely developed, and so your perception is your reality. And that's when you begin to lower your self-esteem, because you're not matching. You're not matching up to the others. You're not getting as many likes. You're not as valued. You don't have as much likability, and that's where the problems start to come in.
Well, and one of the things we need to do is not just say to kids, here are all the things you can't do on social media. It's like taking a kid to a playground and dropping them off and saying, don't go on the slide, it's dangerous. Don't go on the swings, you might fall backwards, and have fun. We have to tell them what to do. And one of the important things that we can guide kids to do is to build a more balanced profile on social media. So not just 100 selfies, but, you know, if you think about it in terms of percentages, let's make 10% inspirational quotes, 10% pictures of your friends, 10% pictures of your pet, and create a more well-rounded image online. But if we're not guiding kids, they don't get that.
There's also a lot of nasty stuff going on online. I don't mean sexual. I mean just snarky comments that are hurtful and that are intended to be hurtful in some cases, but maybe in others not. Or maybe they're misconstrued because of the lack of inflection in the message. How do you tell a kid, don't pay attention to that snarky comment that came back to you on Twitter or whatever?
Well, a lot of my work in schools in America and actually around the world is helping schools really think about how schools and parents together can prepare children to be digital citizens in this new world. And I think more and more the research is certainly supporting the need for teaching both digital citizenship throughout every grade in school, as well as different kinds of social and emotional intelligence tools. For example, how to know when to get off of a site, or how to have the courage to say, that's not cool, that's mean, and how to report a peer, which is really challenging. It's hard enough to stop a peer when they're doing something cruel in real life. It's also very difficult to do it online. So I think that we have to understand kids are works in progress, as was said earlier, their capacity for self-control, their impulsivity, their ability to think about their consequences are not fully developed. And you juxtapose that with the reality that many sites are wonderful social networking sites, but some sites like Whisper and Kik and Yik Yak, WhatsApp, even Instagram, can be used or created to get kids into a social networking area where it's kind of cool to be cool. So you really have to help your children, both at school and at home, learn how to be very savvy about what kind of culture this is, what kind of group online posse this is. Is this a pro-social gaming Minecraft group, or is this a Minecraft group of kids who are really nasty? And make smart choices. And that is going to be need to be part of education, both at home and at school.
You've talked about this too, Michelle, in your many columns and in your book. But how do you explain it to kids? How do you draw the line? And how do you know they're listening to you?
The knowing that they're listening is just sort of a leap of faith. You know, like all important talks that you have with your child, sometimes they seem very vacant during the conversation, but they can recall it later. And it's not a one-and-done conversation. It's the kind of thing where you talk about these things without judgment, because as soon as your child feels like you're judging their action, they pull away. And you have to remember, when we were kids, imagine our parents listening in on all of our telephone calls. How embarrassing that would be to have to make all of our social mistakes right in front of our parents' eyes. So
they kind of did. There was one there was one phone in the house. It was in the kitchen.
You didn't string the cord all the way around the corner? Well,
sometimes I did.
Yeah.
But there were also extension phones, and occasionally you would hear a click.
Right. Right. So We respect the fact that they are going to make mistakes, that there are going to be blunders, and we talk to them with a very neutral expression and a neutral tone of voice that is more exploratory and less judgmental. And that's how you get kids to engage. And you look at their social media, you're aware of what's going on, and you use it to connect. The other important bit of advice is, if you're looking at your kid's Instagram, for example, mm-hmm. you don't just talk to them about the things they've done wrong or that are questionable. You say, hey, what a cool post that you did today about that band. I didn't know you liked them. Do you want to listen to them later tonight when we're cooking dinner? So you use it to connect as much as you use it to teach.
Okay. There's one phenomenon that we haven't talked about, and that is this whole thing of posting pictures and text and selfies, things like that. And you wrote a column, Dr. Lacey, not too long ago about teens who take pictures of themselves and their friends at events, and they feel that if they don't take the pictures, voluminous numbers of pictures, and post them, then they won't get credit for having been at the event. It's like their world will end. That's just silly.
Yeah, it's very, it is. And in fact, one of my patients even said it was like it never happened. If she didn't take her cell phone to this event, she wasn't enjoying it as much. She wasn't, because she was anxious that she wasn't going to have proof that it actually happened.
And by not posting it, they would lose status with their friends.
Right, because what did they do that night?
Explain that to me.
They didn't have anything to do that night. They didn't have something to show for a Saturday night out. They didn't have any proof. They didn't get likes. They didn't have the proof to show that they were out and about and likable and had friends. It's always proof. It's not being in the moment. It's living for the posting.
Now, you deal with young adults in your practice, and you deal with all kinds of problems, some of which come from this, some of which don't. But why is this important that you have proof? What's going on psychologically in a person's head that I've got to prove that I was there and I was part of this event, and here I am in my selfie with all my friends and blah, blah, blah. What's going on there?
Well, they're beginning to relate the likes or the amount of friends or different social media terms with their value. So a Pew study said that 92% of teens go online daily, and research tells us that teen girls specifically tend to reveal more about their inner world on social media, so far more than boys. So this makes them a lot more vulnerable to online bullies, predators. So when they post these things, they're increasing their value, they're increasing their likability, and less subject to be bullied or...
I was just going to say that we've done shows on this, that mm-hmm. men don't talk as much as women mm-hmm. in real life. And women share. They're empathetic, and they want to share their lives with others, particularly other women. And they do it through talking and relatability. Is the same thing happening then in social media? If girls feel that they have to talk about these things and guys don't, is it just an extension of that same thing?
I do, and I think it's just the urge that females have to connect more so than the boys. The boys want to be perceived as strong, and they want to show images of strength and popularity, where the girls are more vulnerable. They just innately share more.
Boys just grunt, and it's hard to do that in a text.
The other thing that's happening online, particularly with younger kids, although we see it with adults too, is that by liking something on your social media, you are developing a brand for yourself. So if I go on my Facebook page and I like True Detective, I'm saying something about myself to the people out there. So we gather these things that are badges that help identify who we are as a person to the rest of the world. When you're in middle school and you're figuring out your identity and who you are, social media and all of these posts and all the things that you like become part of that projection of a brand to the rest of the world. So look at me, I like this cool band, or I went to this cool event. That's part of who I am. And that's the struggle of every adolescent, to say to the world, this is who I am. So this is the newest way of doing that.
Is it any, Dr. Steiner, there, is it more dangerous to do it this way through social media? Is it more permanent to do it this way through social media? Is it more impactful? Will it have longer lasting effect if you build your brand, so to speak, which is just on the face of it disgusting, but using social media as the way we, as opposed to the way we've done it more traditionally?
Well, I think that kids are more flexible about around this than grown-ups are. Kids know your brand's going to change, and they tend to cut each other a fair amount of slack, although they will play a sort of revenge game every now and then. If somebody really wants to humiliate someone, they'll go dig and find an old, you know, picture on their profile or their timeline or something. But I think one of the things we have seen in terms of psychological fallout from all of this is that kids have become more socially anxious. They get more nervous going to an event because they want to make, first of all, they're really worried. Are they going to get in the right pictures with the right people? Or are they going to get in a bad picture that someone's going to post? And when you look at everybody's online perfect photos, you think everybody can go to any party, flirt with, you know, great finesse, having such a perfect time. And for some kids, not all kids, in high school as well as college, in the research I did, some of them will say, you know, it just takes so much work to go out there and be perfect. I'd rather sit in my PJs in my room and just hang out with people online. So we're starting to see some, not, you know, again, not for all kids, but some kids, it's making them more socially avoidant. And when you get better at hanging out online and you prefer it more, then you start to feel more nervous and more pressure to be perfect when it comes to socializing in real life. And one of the sad things that the 250 college-age kids, 18 to 25-year-olds I interviewed, said was the following statement. You know, it's so ironic. We're the most connected generation in history, but we're not so good at falling in love and being vulnerable and being real with each other.
And Dr. Malacy, I know that you've done some, you have some experience with patients that we can talk about when we come back that fall into that category of people who are adults now, who have grown up on social media, but don't know how to interact in real life. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nantahala Outdoor Center, providing whitewater rafting, zip line, and kayaking adventures in the North Carolina mountains. More information at noc.com. The Centers for Disease Control reported the number of Americans who died from heroin overdoses quadrupled in the decade ending in 2013. A look at what's behind the nation's surge in heroin addiction and what some communities are doing to fight back, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Perhaps you've had a young person nagging you for a cell phone. Perhaps you have some concerns of your own about how they use cell phones and social media in the early years of life, teen years, tween years, etc. Now's your time to get in on the conversation. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
Everyone has a favorite author, actor, musician, or comedian. At All Things Considered, we don't just bring you the news of the day. We introduce you to the coolest people you thought you knew and learn what really makes them tick. What you hear might just surprise you. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News, conversations that connect.
Hear the latest news from NPR, plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region on All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the use of technology by young people, cell phones and the like. We've gotten into social media a little bit, but all that is connecting through cell phones and computers. With Dr. Catherine Steiner-Adair with the Harvard University Medical School and the author of The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. Dr. Mary Lacey is with us, a doctor in private practice in Ballantyne who deals with exclusively with young people who are in dealing with issues, some of which are around the use of social media. And Michelle Eichardt is author of Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. Dr. Lacey, it isn't just young children who have challenges dealing with social media. You have some young patients who have graduated from college, you say, who have to be retaught about how to have face-to-face relationships because they've spent their high school and college years on social media.
It's true. So we're just now seeing the first generation coming out that had social media in middle school, high school, and college. And in my practice, I spend a lot of time with new graduates, new college graduates. They come out, they're lonely, they're depressed. And we get to the crux of the problem. They're working 40 to 60 hour weeks now because they're new at their job. They're the ones trying to earn their way. And so at work, phones and iPads, they're not allowed. They have to be put away. So face-to-face conversations have to take place. Afterwards, when there's not a lot of time in their day to go home and get prepared for the next day, they're not going out, they're not socializing, you have to basically reteach them to communicate with other people. So you're starting basically with, I tell you a little something about me, you tell me a little something about you, we move a little bit more intimately, then I may reveal something to you, then you reveal to me, don't do it too fast, that's called spotlighting, and then I might think that you, you know, are weird. So it's basically going back through the basic communication patterns, because they are having to have face-to-face relations in these new jobs without phones at all. And vulnerability is something that they have not used in a long time. They have not, they've built these walls with all of the social media, with all of the texting. And those walls are long lasting. And it does take a reprogramming of sorts of the brain to utilize new patterns of socialization, particularly without help, can be, you know, really daunting.
What I'm hearing you say is very scary. I mean, it's telling me that all these social networks that we're building in this computer world are completely not real, and of very little value when you want to get along in the real world.
Well, in my practice, the young adults that I'm seeing, yes, are having to be retaught completely on how to communicate without a device in their hand.
Yeah, I work as a therapist as well, and I want to speak to the other side of it, and that's that I think social networks could be life-saving for young people online.
Mm-hmm.
For children or teenagers or young adults who are growing up in families where they're not a good fit with their family doesn't support their identity, whether it's a sexual identity or they are not, you know, as religiously inclined as their family or whatever, or they're at a school where who they are and what they love and what they're passionate about is seen as nerdy or, you know, ridiculed in some way. Kids can find unbelievable, and young adults can find really wonderful life-saving relationships to people online. And sometimes, you know, if they're growing up in a part of the country or the world where who they are is not tolerated, it can be really, really important. That said, I would also agree. In my practice, what I see is people are very reactive. They don't know how to calm themselves down as well. They don't know how to, as was said, lead with vulnerability. And to listen as empathically, and the research actually supports that this generation of kids, young adults in particular, are not coming out of college and into young adulthood with certain traits that we know are linked to success both at work and in relationships.
And that's because they're spending too much time with screens in their hands?
They're spending a lot of time with screens in their hand. There are other mitigating factors. I think the fact that kids are doing a lot of socializing online, when combined with, we talked about some of the social anxiety, there's a spike in binge drinking in college-age kids to help them get over that anxiety when they go out to frats. You know, we're certainly reading a lot about the serious consequences of not socially healthy drinking in young adults. So there are very critical ages from about 14 to 22 where so much of what you need to learn about is yourself, your own depth, your own values, and how to communicate and relate not only to people like you but people who are different from you, how to have healthy boundaries, and how to be comfortable in your body, your skin, your ethnicity, your race, with people from all over the world, which hopefully you get in school and in college. And those tools come from in real life relationships, in real life conversations. And, you know, it's not that you can't get some of it online, but you don't build the same toolkit, if you will, to go into the workforce, to fall in love as a young adult, to when all of your time is spent on screens.
One of the things that you say, Michelle, is that you have to have rules. Every kid will come up to a mother or a father and say, and one of our emailers or Twitter people here, Wilson on Twitter, says, all my friends have one. All the kids will say that. Whether you wanted to have a cell phone now or not, or be on a social network now or not, all my friends do. So what do you do? How do you set rules for behavior in that world?
Well, your kid's not lying when they say that. They perceive, at least, that everybody has the technology or the social media. Whether it's true or not, your kid really does feel on the outs if they think that a mass group of kids has this way of communicating with each other. So I think you recognize that. And then you establish rules that create a balance. So the first rule that I have is I teach you how to use this tool. So again, like the knife scenario in the kitchen, I'm not just going to send you in and say, start chopping away. Mm-hmm. I show the kid how to properly use it. And primarily what that means to me is having conversations about dignity online. You do nothing that degrades another person online or that would degrade yourself. If I see that happening, I'm going to yank the device or pull you off of that site, whatever it is. Understanding that if I say you need to unfriend someone, you unfriend someone. Otherwise, you have to lose the entire application. So you monitor, you look at it. And then again, you give them guidelines on what to do, not just what not to do. So for instance, giving them ideas on how to have a more balanced profile, I think, is important. Connecting with them on the positive stuff that they're doing online is important. The other bit of advice that I have in this area is if your child is interested in social media, one thing that we did in my family, I let my kids get Instagram accounts, but they had to be hobby accounts, so they couldn't put their own personal name on the account at first. My daughter was into Harry Potter and Hunger Games, so she created an account devoted to that, called it Wand and Arrow, and posted about the books and the things she loved. She got to be at the playground. She got to see what the other people were doing. I monitored it, but it was a good way to dip her toe in the water.
See, now you're smart enough to know all that stuff. I didn't
know
you could
do
that. Yeah. you say something.
For parents who don't know a lot about this, there's a wonderful place to go to teach you about apps, to give you ideas about how to set limits, et cetera. I think Michelle's book, Work, is helpful. My book is helpful. But there's also an online site called Common Sense Media. And if you go to that, www.commonsensemedia.org, it will explain so many things to you about how to set controls, how to create a contract with your child, how to have these conversations. It's a great resource for parents who are not tech savvy.
And you stress, Dr. Lacey, the same thing, of the importance of setting healthy boundaries for kids on these devices.
Healthy boundaries and moderation. So there's also parental controls a lot of people don't know about on your cell phone carrier. My children's phones turn off at 9 o'clock on weekdays and 10 o'clock on weekends. Mm-hmm. It just turns off. There's no argument. There's no turn your phone in, and then I forget to go and pursue the phone. And if the child doesn't turn it in, then we have an argument, and then there's a punishment and a consequence. So I've just gotten to the point. My children are a bit older. The phones just turn off. And that's, I think, on every cell phone carrier's as a list of options for you.
Christy on Twitter says texting is a godsend for many people with autism or other communication disorders because it strips away the nonverbal language. Interesting point. Mm-hmm. Jennifer on Facebook, during school we have a no technology rule Sunday through Friday. No phones at the table. Before my oldest got his cell, he had to sign a good phone behavior contract. One big rule is don't text something you can't say to someone's face. You have that rule, do you not, Michelle?
Right. That's right.
The parent has to do more work to keep up now with technology these days. And Nicole on Twitter writes, our daughter is only 4, but my husband and I use ours, I guess meaning our cell phones, at the table and involve her with whatever we are discussing, watching, if possible. Let's talk about that. Using cell phones at the table. Usually I see, I see everybody doing this in restaurants. I've seen couples at restaurants who sit down and then they immediately go to their phones. They don't say a word to each other. They're in their phones. I see parents who bring kids to restaurants and give them devices, whether they're cell phones or game boxes or whatever they're, but they're completely absorbed by what's in the phone or in the screen. And the good part of that, of course, is that they're not annoying the rest of us. But I'm thinking there's no conversation going on. There's no relatability going on. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
When I interviewed 1,000 kids between the ages of 4 and 18 for the book, one of the things that just stunned me was the consistency with which children of all ages said they felt like they were boring to their parents because their parents let them use tablets at the table, that the grown-ups weren't interested in them, that, yes, on the one hand, it was fun to be able to play, you know, Ninja Fruit Fly or whatever at the table, but they felt the disconnect from their parents. And I could always tell when a child knew the word hypocrite because they would use it. They said, my parents are such hypocrites. They say no phones at the table, and then they're constantly taking calls. And I think, you know, again, they're going to be, if there's an emergency situation where you have to take a call, then take your call, but get up from the table and leave the room and don't make everybody sit there and listen to your conversation. I think that family dinners are and mealtime is important for so many reasons, not the least of which is when we learn how to communicate with other people, how to listen well, even how to sit through a conversation that's boring, which is an important life skill. But as families, it's when we help each other out, we talk about values, and we solve one another's problems. And that's such a precious time for families, and it goes so quickly. And children look to grown-ups to be the role models for how to use these devices.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, because we've talked a lot about setting rules for kids and their use of phones and screens and social media. What about parents? Because parents are, whether they like it or not, setting the example for kids. What does it say to your kid if you pick them up at school and spend the entire ride on the parent's cell phone?
Well, what kids told me, whether they were 6 or 26, is I'm not that interested in you, you know, or what happened in your day isn't as important to me as whoever or whatever is on the other end of this phone that I'm about to grab while you're mid-sentence answering a question I asked you. You know, we don't like it when our sisters or brothers or our spouses do it to us. You know, how was your day at school, honey? Tell me, what was the best part of your day? And then 3 seconds later, parents taking a phone call to make a dinner reservation. It's rude. It's hurtful. It's annoying.
So that's why you have 8 simple steps to strengthen family connections, all
yes.
Dealing with disconnecting from technology at certain times or connecting to it when you're alone.
It's about managing it well. You know, kids don't need our attention 24/7, but there are critical times in the day when they do, and that's what those times are, those 8 times.
You have family rules.
I do, and it's interesting. I've found that it's less important to make rules if you've set a really good foundation early on. Someone asked me recently, do you have a no cell phone rule at the table? And I thought, well, we've never explicitly said that. But we've never really had to, because we've always had dinner together and had conversations, and we have those cards you put in the middle of the table and you can pull them out and ask, you know, what was the weirdest dream you've ever had, or just funny conversation starters. So it's been a routine for us, and the phones never crept in because that's something that we established early on. So I think part of it is just common sense that you don't allow things to creep where you haven't had them before, and to Dr. Siner Adair's point, parents need to set a really good example in that area.
One of our social media people said, if you wouldn't say it to someone's face, don't send it over social media. And I said that you, Michelle, have said that too, but maybe you have. But Dr. Lacey has certainly said it, because I've got it here in a quote. When you tell a young person that, somebody that you're working with, you're trying to deal through some of these anxiety issues that they have, that have cropped up in their lives because of their interaction with social media, and you say, you know, don't say things to in texting or social media that you wouldn't say to somebody's face, does a light bulb go off? How do they react to that?
They do, and they've heard it before. But I think that just the definition of empathy and explaining that to them, and that people are on the other end of that device, and they are going to internalize what you've said just as if you'd said it to their face. Even maybe more so, because they're going to mull on it. They're sitting there, they're going to think about it, mull on it. Whereas in person, they might have, you know, immediately reacted with another insult, or you had it engaged in a conversation, and it then would have had a resolution. This just kind of lays there in dead air. Mm. And the person on the other end actually has time to mull and be a long pause.
I think it's really interesting. You only have 40 seconds left, but I think it's really interesting that social media and the use of it through these phones and other devices, we forget sometimes that there's a person on the other side. We're trying to communicate with people, and yet we forget that people are on the other side. Why?
Because
the anonymity of the screen.
Yep.
Wow.
It's a big factor.
So there's a big education curve that has to go through this, and parents, I guess, have to be ahead of the curve somehow. And I'm going to give out that website again, commonsensemedia.org. I didn't know about that. So if you're a parent and you feel technologically deficient, that's a good place to start. Dr. Catherine Steiner Adair, author of The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. Michelle Eichardt, author of Middle School Makeover, Improving the Way You and Your Child Experience the Middle School Years. And Dr. Mary Lacey, a doctor of behavioral health in private practice in Ballantyne. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.